Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas. All persons having business before the Honorable Supreme Court of Texas are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the state of Texas and this honorable court.
Thank you. Be seated. This morning, the court has three causes on its oral submission docket. In the order of their presentation, they are as follows. NME Hospitals Incorporated versus Margaret Reynolds, M.D. from El Paso County. FM Properties Operating versus the City of Austin, a direct appeal from Travis County. And Gloria Marie Hernandez versus Tokai Corporation and Scripto Tokai Corporation, a certified question from the United States Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit. We have allotted 20 minutes for each side to present argument in these cases. Petitioner or appellants may reserve a portion of that time for rebuttal by advising the marshal of the court. We'll take a brief recess in between each argument, then we'll complete the arguments before lunch. If you desire to purchase a tape of any of these arguments, you may make application with our clerk. We're ready to hear arguments from petitioner in NME versus Reynolds.
May I introduce the court? Mr. Kenneth Carr will present an argument with petitioner. Petitioner is reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Please, please report. Dr. Reynolds, in this case, alleges that she was a victim of sex discrimination and retaliation by her employer, Sierra Laboratory Associates. But she knows that she cannot sue Sierra Laboratory Associates because they do not have 15 employees. So the question today is, can she sue a Texas employer, Sierra Medical Center or NME Hospitals, by whom she admittedly has never been employed, never sought to be employed under any state statute? Now, she cannot sue, we believe it's clear, and we will address this in a minute. She cannot sue under the federal law, Title VII, the Civil Rights Act, so the Fifth Circuit has so held. So can she has sought, in this case then, to sue Sierra Medical Center under the Texas equivalent of Title VII, which is the Texas Commission on Human Rights Act. The problem is the legislature has said that the Texas courts are to interpret the TECRA, that's the acronym for Texas Commission on Human Rights Act, in such a way as to achieve the same result as if she had sued under the federal law.
May I interrupt and ask you?
Yes, Justice.
What is the claim that you're appealing that she asserts? What's left?
What is left is a claim under TECRA for retaliation by Sierra Medical Center because we were on notice that she was complaining about an unlawful employment practice by Sierra Laboratory Associates.
So it's the sex discrimination claim only?
It's strictly the sex discrimination claim. That's correct, John.
And would it be a fair statement that NME is sued because of, quote, a conspiracy with the laboratory to accomplish this discrimination?
That is a second count, but it's a...
Well, but you have to have a tort in the first place to use conspiracy in the second place, don't you?
Certainly. Yes, sir.
So if the claim against the laboratory is a valid one, then the fact issue is whether NME conspired to carry out that.
That would be the case. But I think it's admitted that she cannot maintain any sort of discrimination against SLA because they're not covered by the law. They have fewer than 15 employees. In other words, put another way.
So in other words, your view is that the laboratory can't discriminate because it's not covered by either law. Therefore, the conspiracy claim fails because there's no tort.
That's correct.
No statutory tort.
That's correct, Your Honor.
But then that's all that's left is the statutory
tort. In our opinion, yes, sir.
Thank you.
Would you clarify one fact for me?
Absolutely.
And the import of the fact. In the CA opinion, and at least in the respondent's brief, they say that Fry told Pester that he had no plans to allow Reynolds to become a shareholder in SLA and requested Pester's help. How can that be? How can Fry have no plans to allow her to become a shareholder if he has no control over her?
Well, Your Honor, I can't answer that question, and because that's a fact issue that's in dispute, we have assumed it, of course, for summary judgment purposes, but Mr. Fry and Dr. Pester both denied that that statement was made. I think the theory is that he would in some way use whatever pressure Sierra had on Sierra Laboratory Associates to induce that result. I believe that's the theory.
And if that situation exists where that type of pressure can be exerted to require someone to be terminated, why would that not establish the type of relationship that would bring this within the act?
Well, Your Honor, it wouldn't for a couple of reasons. First of all, we believe that the case law shows that there has to be a direct employment relationship between Dr. Reynolds and Sierra. She has disclaimed any effort to establish that. As one of the amicus briefs suggests, there is an out perhaps left by the Fifth Circuit for a person to attempt to do that under the common law control hybrid test, but she has disclaimed any desire to do that in this case.
But there's some notion of a hybrid or a modified Sibley test because of the language in Title VII, or I guess TECRA, that says discrimination by an employer harming a person. They don't use the word employee, but they use person, and is something more than simply a conspiracy here. There is some discussion about, by the use of the word person, was it meant to cover somebody other than strictly a direct employee?
If I might address that at some length, Your Honor, because I think that's an important question, and I think if one understands the history, he'll see that that argument is not a valid argument. To do so, I think it's imperative that one compare the language of the federal statute, Section 704A of Title VII. It's codified in 42 U.S.C. Section 2000E-3A. And then compare that with the comparable state language. The federal language says it shall be an unlawful employment practice for an employer to discriminate against any of his employees or applicants for employment. That's one. For an employment agency or joint labor management committee controlling apprenticeship or training, retraining, on-the-job training to discriminate against any individual. That's two. Or for a labor organization to discriminate against any member thereof or applicant for membership. That's three. Because he has opposed any practice made an unlawful employment practice by this subchapter, that is, by Title VII. Now, you compare the state statute. The state statute I submit the legislature simply wanted to chop down fewer trees, so they greatly shortened the language, but I don't think they intended any different result. An employer, a labor union, or an employment agency, they lump them all together, commits an unlawful employment practice if the employer, labor union, or employment agency retaliates or discriminates against a person who under this chapter opposes a discriminatory practice. You see the very close parallel in language, and I'd submit that the only reason the legislature used person instead of his employee, individual, union member three times is to shorten it, and the only generic noun that fits in the legislature's formulation of this provision is person or individual.
But if we're required to apply this law similarly to Title VII, then don't you have a U.S. District Court opinion out of East Texas that talks about a modified?
It does.
Don't we run into this problem?
Well, you would, Your Honor, if the Fifth Circuit hadn't clearly repudiated it. The Daniels case out of the Eastern District we submit is clearly not the law in the Fifth Circuit, because they, the Fifth Circuit has made it, I think it was as clear as early as 1990 in Fields' case, but if there was any question left in 1997 in Bloom, you see, Daniels is, the analysis in Daniels is based on the Sibley case out of the D.C. Circuit. The Fifth Circuit in 1997 said Sibley is not law in the circuit, so Daniels is not good law. And that's one reason the court doesn't have to concern itself with Daniels. But the only reason the legislature said person rather than the threefold analysis, and I say the only reason, I cannot find any legislative history to the contrary, can't find any court to the contrary. In fact, all the legislative history says the Supreme Court intended the same, the legislature intended the same result under state law as controls under federal law.
Looking at the current status of federal law, hasn't the D.C. Circuit itself in 1979 modified its original test in Sibley so that it too follows the hybrid economic realities common law control test?
No question about it.
And since 1979, the D.C. Circuit has only applied that test.
That's correct.
Right? Is it safe to say that uniformly throughout the circuit that is the test that is applied under Title VII, or are there any circuits left to apply the pure Sibley test?
I do not know of any circuits that still apply the pure Sibley test.
And so really, the Fifth Circuit, in interpreting it, if we focus on the Fifth Circuit cases,
right,
does require an employment relationship, but it may not be the classic one. It is in connection with this particular test.
They define
it as an employment relationship.
Yes, but the court, but Dr. Reynolds has disclaimed any effort to come under that in this case.
She's claiming that there need not be any relationship, any type of employment relationship under any test whatsoever.
That's right.
The point of my question is, do we have really any debate under federal law with respect to what the requirement is vis-a-vis an employment relationship under Title VII?
Your Honor, we certainly don't in the Fifth Circuit. There are some old cases in other circuits that would suggest they may rule differently, but not in the Fifth Circuit.
But are most of those cases, do they predate the development of this hybrid test?
Most of them do, Your Honor. Yes, ma'am.
You mentioned earlier that the Texas legislature had indicated that our law should be that the state should develop its law consistent with federal law within this circuit.
It doesn't say within this circuit, but it says consistent with federal law. That's 21.001.
Why would you have that? Let's read that. That's this particular circuit.
Well, because if you don't, you have forum shopping, Your Honor. I mean, obviously the U.S. Supreme Court can trump the Fifth Circuit, but until they do. If you go into federal court under Title VII in Texas, if this case had been brought, in other words, under Title VII, it had been thrown out of court by Judge Hudspeth out in El Paso.
What do you have to show that statutory language, that the concern was forum shopping rather than the concern was that we're drafting a law modeled after the federal law and we want our courts to have a body of law to look to?
Well, I think, I don't respectfully, honestly, much of a dichotomy between those two. The reason they wanted you to look at the federal law was so that it would be interpreted consistently. And it seems to me that that's what you need to do. And that's what the legislature clearly directed. If I might, let me make one other point before my time expires on the language of 21055. That statute, again, says an employer, et cetera, commits an unlawful employment practice if the employer retaliates or discriminates against any person who, under this chapter, don't overlook that phrase, under this chapter, opposes a discriminatory practice. And on page 3 of her brief, the respondent makes it very clear that she is opposing a discriminatory practice, discriminatory employment practice at FLA. But that can't, by definition, be an opposition under this chapter because SLA is not covered by this chapter being TEPRA. So even if you look at 21055, and even if you say person is intended to be interpreted differently from the 704A, and I don't concede that, you still don't have an opposition to an employment practice under this chapter, because that's the statutory language even under 21055. I would simply also point out that the Court of Appeals decision makes it very clear that their decision is absolutely based on Sibley. And they concluded, I think wrongly, that by relying on Sibley, they would get the state law in accordance with federal law. In page 7 of their decision, they say, we believe that by applying the Sibley doctrine here, we are synthesizing federal and state common law by recognizing an established federal common law exception to the general rule, and that is not, in fact, true. Consequently, persons bringing causes of action under state law are afforded the same protection that they would enjoy under the federal law. They understand the rationale and the reasoning behind the statutory instruction to follow federal law. They just got it wrong on Sibley. And their very, almost next to last sentence of their opinion says, because we hold that Sibley doctrine controls, we find the trial judge erred in granting the hospital's motion for summary judgment.
Any other questions?
What is the significance of the Bender case?
Your Honor, we don't think Bender changes anything. It says we assume, for the sake of argument, that the Fourth Circuit's going to adopt Sibley, and then went on to say, but even if it did, it wouldn't help the plaintiff in that case. But they expressly don't adopt the Sibley rationale. They say it's just not necessary to decide.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
The court is ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Dennis Richard will present argument for the respondent.
Just stab at the significance of the Bender case is, and this also for Justice Hankinson would answer your question as well, is the Bender case makes it clear that every circuit court that has addressed the Sibley doctrine issue has adopted it. Mr. Carr made the statement about the Spiridis case changing Sibley. I would submit to the court that if you would look at the cases that we have cited in the First Circuit, Carports versus Automotive Wholesalers Association, the Second Circuit, Spurt versus Teachers Insurance Annuity, the Sixth Circuit, Christopher B. Stouter, the Ninth Circuit, Gomez v. Alexian Brothers, Mitchell v. Frank R. Howard Memorial Hospital, Lutcher versus Musicians Union Local. These are all circuit court opinions that came after the Spiridis case. The Eleventh Circuit, Pordazzi versus Coleman. They're all cases that have held that the Sibley Doctrine is applicable, and it is applicable to a case that...
But even in Sibley, the court acknowledged that there must be at least a nexus. There is a control element. It is not just anyone off the street who happens to employ 15 people.
Absolutely. And isn't it then,
as a result of that, these other circuit cases in the Spiridis case actually just a refinement of the fact of how you define the control or the nexus?
Well, let me just say that the Diggs case, which is the Fifth Circuit case, made this statement. There must be some nexus with an employment relationship for Title VII to apply, but the connection need not necessarily be direct.
Exactly.
Margaret Reynolds had a relationship.
Well, I understand that, but so your position, though, as I understand it, is that there need not be any employment relationship. And my question to you is that even starting with Sibley, there is a nexus and control requirement that the federal courts have refined over the last 25 years. And so now, in fact, the Fifth Circuit talks in terms of an employment relationship, but it's not the classic direct employment relationship. They're talking about the control and economic reality.
Our position has never been that Margaret Reynolds does not have to have an employment relationship. She had an employment relationship with Sierra Laboratory Associates. She was a pathologist employed by that group. And the other part,
But your position is that she need not have any employment relationship if we call call it indirect or whatever, under any test with respect to the defendant that she's suing under the act?
I would take the position then, and it's set forth in the Bender case, and this, by the way, provides the protection that people have expressed in the amicus briefs about concern about expanding litigation, that there be a de facto relationship, an indirect relationship, and I'll show in a moment why that is.
And is the indirect relationship that hybrid economic realities common law control test of the Fifth Circuit and a lot of the other circuits are applying?
Well, it doesn't have to be all of those criteria, although I'll show you in a moment most of them are present with regard to mortgage rentals and Sierra Medical
Center. Well, before we get to the application, though, is it a fair statement that federal law generally does use some version of the economic realities control test in looking at the relationship between the plaintiff and the defendant in a Title VII case?
If you're going to try to establish direct employment, as direct employment versus independent contractor, but if you're showing that there's been interference by a third party, I believe all that is necessary is to show that you have a common law agency relationship. Margaret Reynolds clearly had that relationship with Sierra Laboratory Associates and Sierra Medical Center interfering with
that
relationship.
Explain that to me further, please.
Well, she is an employee of Sierra Laboratory Associates. Sierra Medical Center exerts certain control over that relationship. The control they had was she had to be a specialist in pathology. She had to work certain hours. They had coverage of 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 52 weeks a year. She could not work for any other group. She could not see any other patients. She could not get a substitute for her physician by going out and just asking somebody to cover for her. The hospital had to approve it. She could not have ownership in Sierra Laboratory Associates without the approval of Sierra Medical Center, which is the quintessential statement of control.
But aren't you then evaluating the relationship between the medical center and her under this hybrid test? Isn't that what you're really doing?
Well, what I'm saying to you is that a certain amount of control has been demonstrated and is demonstrated by Sierra Medical Center over her.
But in order for us to understand the legal significance of that control, we have to know what legal test we should be looking at. And what I've heard you say is that you're claiming that we should be looking at the medical center and Dr. Reynolds and looking at the amount of control that exists and the economic realities of that circumstance. And isn't that the hybrid test that has evolved from Sidley?
The hybrid test is a test that's been applied when someone's trying to show a direct employment relationship. That's not what Sidley is about. Sidley is about showing an indirect or a de facto employment and that someone, another employer, is exerting control over that employee of another employer's access to the job market. And that's what Sibley's attempting to do. Another statement, which I think is significant from the Diggs case, and I'd ask the court to simply read the Diggs case because the Diggs case supports Margaret Reynolds in this case. And the Diggs court said this: Diggs was not employed. She is a black female doctor. Was not employed, nor did she seek employment by a professional association. She tried to show that she had an employment relationship with her patients. Whereas in our case, Margaret Reynolds was employed by a professional association, Sierra Laboratory Associates. And what the court and Diggs, the Fifth Circuit, was saying is that we would recognize a situation like Sibley. They didn't have to get to Sibley in the Diggs case because they could state, and I think accurately did, that you cannot argue that relationship between patient and doctor is an employee-employer relationship. So you don't have an interference with that employment relationship.
May I ask you a question, the same one I asked Mr. Carr? What is the claim against NME that you're asserting here that the fact issue is about?
Well, the claim that we've asserted is that in October of 1993, Sierra Medical Center was on notice that Margaret Reynolds Reynolds was opposing a discriminatory practice, sex discrimination in her employment. They were on notice of that. And over the course of the next several months that followed, there was various contacts between Mark Frye and the head of the pathology department that Margaret Reynolds worked for. And in those communications, he expressed his dissatisfaction. She had this claim pending, things of that nature. And basically, it culminated on April the 4th of 1994. Mark Frye goes in to Judy Pester, who is one of the shareholders in Sierra Laboratory Associates, and says, I don't plan to have Margaret Reynolds as a partner in Sierra Laboratory Associates. I want your help to see to it that that doesn't happen. And she says, I'll do whatever it takes. At the time that they had that conversation, the paperwork to make her a shareholder had already been started. The employment agreement that she was supposed to sign, all the things that would continue her employment at Sierra Laboratory Associates were in progress. When Mark Frye makes his statement, it all stops.
Well, is it correct then that the basis of what's left in the lawsuit as far as NME is concerned is conspiring with the laboratory to continue the sexual discrimination in the face of that complaint?
And retaliation against her for having opposed the discriminatory practice.
Mr. Richard, going back to this nexus issue, if I understand your position, if I just happen to be a friend of an individual employing Ms. Reynolds, and I just tell my friend, you know, I don't think you ought to employ Ms. Reynolds, I don't like the looks of her hair, or whatever basis I have, let's assume it's some sort of discriminatory basis that's otherwise prohibited. As you say, SLA itself has less than 15 employees, so there's no direct liability for them to discriminate. But you're saying the mere fact that I've interfered with that relationship when she is fired subjects me to this TECRA complaint?
Not at all, because I believe that the evidence is clear. There has to be a relationship. There has to be a certain amount of control that is being exerted by the person that's doing the interfering. They have to
in the nature of some sort of employment relationship.
They have to be able to control access to employment opportunities. Clearly, Sierra Medical Center had that kind of control over Margaret Reynolds.
Well, I mean, I might control the access to employment opportunities with my good friend, but I was kind of confused with your answers, Jess Hankson. You're arguing that you don't need any sort of employment type nexus, but on the other hand, you're saying you have to have some sort of employment type nexus with this individual.
Okay. The employment type nexus is that there has to be a relationship of employment. In our case, Margaret Reynolds, Sierra Laboratory Associates.
That's part of the hypothetical.
And what I'm saying is the Fifth Circuit made this statement. There must be some nexus with an employment relationship for Title VII to apply, but the connection need not necessarily be direct. She doesn't have to be the employee of Sierra Medical Center in order to pursue this claim.
And that's my point. So I happen to be an employer. I have more than 15 employees. I just happen to be a good friend of who heads up Sierra Laboratories, and I just tell them I don't think you ought to hire Reynolds, and they don't. So I am liable under the TECRA for this violation. Or is there something more in terms of my relationship to Reynolds that's necessary for there to be this nexus of indirect relationship?
And I believe that two things. One, you have to be an employer subject to the act, so you'd have to have more than 15 employees. So if you're just an individual who comes in and gives your opinion, you're not subject to the act. The second thing is, I believe that the case law that has interpreted the Sibley Doctrine and the Bender case is a good, very recent statement of it, says that there has to be a relationship. You have to show that there's some kind of control that could be exercised. In this situation, Sierra Medical Center had the ultimate control. They could say whether or not Margaret Reynolds could be an employee, and did. And she no longer was an employee after that. So there is I believe that you have copies of the Bender opinion, but it does make the statement uh, articulate in the opinion that there has to be that type of relationship. There has to be some kind of control that could be. If that's the safeguard for you justices about the concern from the amicus briefs. Basically what we have is this. If the court adopts the position that's being advanced by the petitioner, then Sierra Medical Center could go out and place a sign in front of the hospital that says, we don't allow female doctors in our pathology department, in our radiology department, in our emergency room, and have no consequence for it. And no physician group is going to hire a female doctor and risk losing that lucrative exclusive contract. And if they did hire a female doctor, then that doctor could be fired at the insistence of Sierra Medical Center and there'd be no recourse. Ladies and gentlemen, that's not the law, and it should not be the law. The statute is clear. You do not have to be a direct employee of the employer who's subject to the act. It's clear with regard to the...
I gather then you would say that the actual employer, in this case, SLA, doesn't have to be subject to the act.
No, they do not have to be subject to the act. You know, one other point about showing that this direct employment is not required is the situation with regard to Title VII saying any individual. Title VII, for the person who can make a complaint, is the person aggrieved. It doesn't say employee. And the Sibley case said that if the remedy is for a class that is broader than the direct employees, then there's a strong indication that the prescriptions of Title VII reach beyond the immediate employee-employer relationship. And you'll find that the language that I'm talking about parallels. In the Texas Commission on Human Rights Act, it says the person aggrieved can bring the complaint.
But even under the factual circumstances here, you're still agreeing, as I understand, with Justice Hankinson's questioning, that some aspect of control is necessary even in the indirect situations that exist here.
I believe that there should be some, you in essence become an indirect or de facto employee. I believe some control is there.
Isn't that hybrid test? Isn't that what's applied in the absence of a direct relationship?
Well, they want to apply the hybrid test to say that there is no employee.
Well, I understand in terms of application, but just looking at your legal test, how do we determine the amount of control? Isn't that where the Fifth Circuit and a lot of the other federal courts have used this hybrid control test?
They've always used the hybrid control test whenever the issue was employee versus independent contractor, where you're just making a direct employment claim. In instances where the person...
Well, but in the deal case that involved where we had the insurance company and the agent, there was never any contention that, in fact, the agent who was suing was directly employed by State Farm. The question was whether or not State Farm had enough control over the test to rise to the level of this indirect de facto employment relationship under the test that this circuit applied so that Title VII could be applied. Isn't that, am I missing the boat?
Well, in Deal, there never was an attempt to say, hey, State Farm is an indirect employer and State Farm interfered with my employment with Mr. Hunt. That never was argued because it couldn't be argued. State Farm didn't do anything like Mark Fry did in Sierra Medical Center where he comes in and demands...
But we keep going back to facts, and I'm just trying to clarify where you are on the law. I mean, the way I read Deal, we have this gentleman who ends up... I'm sorry, a woman who ends up suing the agency she worked for and State Farm. And she tried to make a Title VII claim against State Farm, right? For interfering with her relationship.
No, she tried to make a claim against State Farm as a direct employee-employer relationship. She tried to say that State Farm was her employer directly. Sibley has never mentioned that case.
And didn't she do that because of Field, in which the Fifth Circuit had decided that the amount of control was going to be this hybrid test?
True again, if it's an employee-employer direct employment claim, but not a Sibley. Sibley wasn't mentioned in Field. It wasn't mentioned in Deal. And I want to, just one other thing, Justice Hankinson, I want to make clear. to distinguish for you that Spiridis v. Reinhart case. First of all, it's a 1979 case, and all those cases I mentioned a moment ago that apply civilly were after that case. But the other point about it is that was an issue was employee versus independent contractor. There was never an issue in that case about a third-party employer interfering. That also considered a 1972 amendment to the Civil Rights Act, and that amendment applied to federal employees, and the amendment said that you had to be actions affecting employees or applicants for employment. It is different than the Civil Rights Act, which talks about individuals and persons.
Well, Mr. Sherrill, let me ask you, now it's, maybe it's dawning on me, you now agree, in fact, you agree with Mr. Carr's position that Ms. Reynolds isn't even arguing she's an indirect employee of NME. You accept, he mentioned that in his argument, that you're not arguing that she's even an indirect employee of NME. Do I understand you now to be saying that's correct?
No, I would argue that she demonstrates that there was a significant amount of control by Sierra Medical Center over enough to make the statement that she's an indirect or de facto employee.
Well, Judge Hankins has been asking you what is the standard for determining whether indirect employee, and you said, well, that's not relevant here. We're not talking about direct employee or indirect. We're talking about something else. And going back, Mr. Carr has said that Ms. Reynolds has conceded that she is not trying to establish either a direct employee or an indirect employee relationship. And from your argument, I understand you to be saying that the Sibley, all the Fifth Circuit and Sibley tests and deal have all gone to whether or not there's an employment relationship, direct or indirect, and so you're not using any of that now.
What I'm saying is that Margaret Reynolds had a direct employment relationship with Sierra Laboratory Associates. No question about that.
Well, we're not arguing about that.
Okay. And all I'm saying is to provide the safeguards that you're looking for.
Are you saying she has an indirect employment relationship with NME? That's all I'm asking.
I believe she does.
Okay. Now,
how does that arise?
Because of the control that NME exerts over her.
Well, is this more like a traditional independent contractor situation and determining whether a third party exercises control over an independent contractor to the extent that they're going to be responsible for their bad acts? Is that what you're talking about? In other words, it has nothing to do with being an indirect employee, it just has to do with control of a company over an independent contractor that works in their facility.
All I'm saying is that the Sibley Doctrine relies upon the ability of one employer to control an employee of another employer's access to the job market.
But you use the word employer because it's defined in the Texas Act. And you could use any other. You could use a general contractor over an independent. You could still, what I'm trying to get to are the legal theories that you're talking about have to do with exercising control that makes a person responsible for their acts to that employee or from somebody else? Or are you just going on Sibley and that's it?
Well, I'm going on Sibley, and if you look at Sibley, you'll find that there has to be that kind. There has to be an employment relationship that's interfered with, and I believe we've shown that. And I believe that to satisfy any concerns that the court has about having all kinds of litigation, that the Bender case is telling you that there has to be a certain amount, a de facto or indirect employment. And I think we've met that.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
I think it is highly instructive that until Justice Hankinson forced Mr. Richard to do so, he studiously avoided citing any Fifth Circuit case more recent than 1988. That's the Diggs case. In the Diggs case, the Fifth Circuit expressly stated they weren't reaching the control question in this case. They said, we even if we were to hold that Harris Hospital could violate the provisions of Title VII by interfering with Diggs's relationship with the third party, a question we do not reach, that relationship would have to be an employment relationship. But since then, and Mr. Richard is very, very eager to rely not on that language, but at least other portions of Diggs, but he has totally ignored Fields, totally ignored Deal, he's totally ignored Bloom. Bloom, in fact, never came up. But Bloom, in 1997, says Sibley is contrary to the precedent of the Fifth Circuit. I don't see how that could be stated any more clearly. In that, Mr. Richard, one of the cases he cited in support of his position is the First Circuit case, the car parts case. The Fifth Circuit expressly said, we don't accept car parts. It's relying on Sibley. That's not the law in this circuit.
If we accept the law as articulated by other circuits, not the Fifth Circuit, do you believe?
I think we could lose, depending on which circuit you adopted and to which extent you extended it. But to do so, I would respectfully submit, Your Honor, then absolutely opens up forum shopping questions, and it accomplishes what the legislature said don't do, and that is get different results depending on whether you, a plaintiff sues under Title VII or under Texas. My language is not there in high verb, I can see, but what other purpose did they have in the very first provision of the entire Act, which is 21.001, parenthesis 1, when they directed the Texas courts to interpret the law consistent with federal law?
Isn't our job to more or less guess what the U.S. Supreme Court would say federal law is and not necessarily follow the Fifth Circuit unerringly?
I would respectfully say, no, ma'am, that is not your responsibility. Your responsibility, where the Fifth Circuit has clearly defined the law in the Fifth Circuit, and they have, and where the Supreme Court has cert denied at least two of those three cases that we've relied on, it would be improper for this court to reach a different result. If some 5 years from now the Supreme Court reaches a different result, the U.S. Supreme Court, then I think that would change the law in Texas. But the law today that you should follow, I would respectfully submit, is the Fifth Circuit law.
If it weren't for that provision about federal law, and if we were just looking at the facial language of this statute, wouldn't you lose?
No, sir. I would respectfully suggest that we would still prevail. There are four subparts in 21055. There are four things that you can't, a person can't, a covered employer can't retaliate for. The last three clearly have no application to this case, because the retaliation, because the plaintiff has made a charge or filed a complaint or testified, because, first of all, and the only one that would ever apply in this case is filing a charge, and that was done in May of 96, and the alleged retaliation by Mr. Fry was on April 4th. Of 96, so it can't possibly have been done because she filed a charge. So the only one that she can possibly rely on is because she has opposed a discriminatory practice. But to do that, Your Honor, she must show that she has opposed a discriminatory practice under this chapter, that is under TECRA, and opposing discrimination by Sierra Laboratory Associates is not opposing discrimination under this chapter because Sierra Laboratory Associates is not covered by the chapter.
Any other questions?
Thank you, Your Honor.
That concludes the argument in the first case.